Teach Me to Code, episode 37. Hey everybody, and welcome back to the Teach Me to Code podcast. You might have noticed our new theme music. What happened was I got tired of the old theme music, and basically the problem was is it only went about 40 seconds, and the introduction always went longer than that. So I decided to go for it and pick up something that went a little longer and kind of gave a good background to what I was talking about here. So basically, here's what I'm doing is I'm just going to go over the few announcements, and then we'll get into the interview for today with Peter Cooper. First off, I'd like to thank our sponsors. We have New Relic. New Relic is one of the best application management tools out there. It identifies trouble spots by capturing response times, breaking down your requests, telling you where your slowdowns occur, and tracking errors and exceptions. I use New Relic, and I think you ought to check them out at newrelic.com. We're also sponsored here by Chargeify. Chargeify is a tool that allows you to manage charges and subscriptions. They have a great and easy-to-use API, and if you're making charges in your application or you need to manage sponsorships, they are a great way to go, and you can find them at chargeify.com. Finally, I am a sponsor of this podcast. If you need help with your Ruby or Rails application, you're looking for somebody to do more than just programming, maybe training, coaching, code reviews, setup, continuous integration, you know, help you with some of your agile processes, I'm available for that. And you can call me at 801-367-6164. And I love helping people out. That's why I do this. So, you know, feel free to go ahead and give me a call. Finally, I'm going to be putting out a survey this week, and basically what I'm looking for is I want to do some more in-depth tutorials, you know, something that's a little bit larger than what can be covered in a half-hour podcast or screencast, and so I'm going to be putting together some larger products, and I want to know what you're interested in. So in return for your help, I'm giving away 5 brand new books from the Pragmatic Programmers and 5 videos from Peep Code. Just to thank you for your support, and I want to thank them for chipping in and helping me out. So if you have any suggestions for topics or techniques that you want to see covered, go ahead and follow me on Twitter as cmaxwood and or cmaxw, and I'll post when I have that survey ready. Also, go to teachmetocode.com, and on the right you will see a sign-up link for the newsletter. I just got the newsletter going. I'm going to be posting that every Wednesday or Thursday, so sign up for that. And finally, you can leave feedback for the show by calling in at 801-753-8279 or emailing me at chuck@teachmetocode.com, and you can follow me on Twitter at cmaxw. And on to the podcast, or on to the interview. Hey everybody, this is Charles Max Wood with Teach Me to Code podcast, and today our guest is Peter Cooper. If you don't know who Peter is, he's one of those amazing technology guys in Northern England. He's the author of Beginning Ruby, that was published by A-Press. He is also responsible for numerous resources for Ruby and other developers, including Ruby Inside, Ruby Flow, Rails Inside, and Coder.io. He also started Mobile Orchard, and I think somebody else is running that now. But he's been involved in a lot of other things related to the Ruby community, and I'd like to just welcome him to the show.
Hi there, Charles. Oh, and everyone listening, of course.
So the scheduling's kind of interesting, because I think we're like 6 or 7 hours off from each other.
Yeah, 7, yeah.
So I guess it's afternoon or evening there.
Yeah, it's just turned 3 o'clock. I think it's 8 at your end.
Yeah, it's 8 in the morning.
So
here
you're up early. That's definitely not the sort of time I'd be doing podcasting. I'd be bleary eyed and, you know, gruff kind of voice, because at that type of time of the morning I'll sound like I'm a smoker, even though I don't smoke. So steer clear in the morning, but that's just me.
Yeah, well, my kids don't give me much of an option. And to be honest, I'd rather get an early start and get done early so that I can come home and be with them. So.
Oh, yeah, I'd love to be a morning person. It's just never quite worked out, unfortunately.
Yeah. So I'm kind of curious. You know, I've always been curious what it would be like to write a book. So, you know, how did you get involved in writing a beginning Ruby book?
Well, just to sum up the how it feels first, just it's real heartache. So keep that in mind as I talk about it. I've always been into like blogging and trying out, you know, sort of new social media things even before it was really called social media. Online, just playing around and enjoying using the internet, really. And I'd been blogging since about 1999. I think it was my birthday I started, actually, for some reason. And obviously I was talking about Ruby and Rails and the stuff that I was getting into at the time, from sort of 2004 onwards, which is when I sort of first picked up Ruby and Rails. And, you know, there weren't many people really blogging about it, other than, you know, the people that you might recognize as sort of Rails hotshots now, you know, like DHH himself, and I think Rick Olson, and I think Jeffrey Grossen, actually, I think he might have been a little bit later, Jeffrey, but, you know, there were people like that. It was all, you know, people that were really deep into Rails at the time were the ones blogging about it. And I just happened to be blogging about Ruby, and a sort of acquisitions editor at A-Press had obviously been searching around Google or whatever for Ruby blog or whatever, come across some of my posts, and then got in touch and said, oh, you know, we've seen your post, we've seen that you do Ruby, so on. You know, this is before I even had a Ruby specific blog, it was just a few different Ruby posts on my personal blog. And he says, you know, we want to do a book about Ruby, we haven't, you know, done one yet. We've got I think they actually did have a beginning Rails commerce or something like in the pipeline, but they had nothing specifically about Ruby. So he's like, you know, let's discuss some ideas. So I think they wanted to do something that was quite advanced to start with, something very sort of a very specific Ruby related topic. But I said, you know, like there's a real lack of a good like introductory book. And I mean, there was the Pickaxe, of course, but the Pickaxe was very much a kind of tutorial at the start, although the way it walks through is a bit of an odd order, just for someone who's like really, really, really totally new to like object orientation and so on. It expects you to understand a lot of the underlying concepts already. And then like the latter half is like obviously a really good reference that, you know, most Rubyists will have used at some point. But I thought, well, hang on, why can't we come up with a book that is from start to finish pretty much entirely tutorial, and goes into enough depth so that people who don't understand concepts like object orientation or perhaps have only done a bit of HTML even can dive in and sort of learn the whole thing from start to finish. And they thought that was a great idea, slightly bigger idea than they were, you know, planning to do. And it did end up taking us quite a long time, but we eventually managed to pull it off. And I think it changed editors a couple of times because it ended up, you know, being such a big project. But we eventually got there, and so it's pretty much luck. I stumbled into it, and it was just, like many people, one of my ambitions was to write a book one day. And so it went from there, and, you know, ambition achieved.
Huh. Well, that's interesting. You know, I think when you talk to a lot of authors, it turns out that they approach the publishing house, not the other way around. And, you know, it's interesting that, yeah, you become a prolific blogger, and then, you know, they kind of go, oh, well, you seem to know about this, and we want a book about it, so let's go for it.
Yeah, I must say, actually, my strategy with a lot of things tends to be more of a fisherman than a hunter. I sort of just, you know, hang out, you know, my shingle out there and, you know, show off the different things that I'm working on or thinking about, and then people tend to get in touch with me and say, oh, we could do this, we could do that, and then it goes from there. I guess I'm not very, I don't tend to pursue people or publishers or anything like that so much. I like to, you know, my work to sort of stand on its own merits, which actually, in hindsight, isn't the best trait. You know, often there is a good reason to go out there and pursue people. But it seems to have worked out for me so far, and I'm sort of finally getting to that point now where I've, you know, sort of confident enough about my portfolio of work where I am, you know, approaching more people than I used to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that makes a lot of sense, you know, where I just barely started freelancing on my own, and it's kind of the same thing where, you know, when I first thought about it, it was like, well, you know, I saw my weaknesses, and, you know, just kind of, you know, I hope they'd come to me because I wasn't sure if I could sell them.
Yeah.
And yeah, you know, it's, you know, as you look at what you've done and really kind of realize, hey, you know, I really do have something here, you know, then you become more comfortable going out and saying, hey, look at what I did. And, you know, why don't we team up on this, or you could hire me for that.
Yeah. I mean, that's always been one of my strategies, is sort of playing to my weaknesses, perhaps, rather than strengths necessarily. You know, I try not to get too involved with things that, you know, clearly don't click with how I work. But that said, in the last year or two, I've actually tried to address some of these things. Like, you know, like video blogging, I did a little bit of that over the last several months. Just because it was something that I never tried before, and I think a lot of developers, especially me, you know, aren't particularly comfortable on video or recording videos, putting videos on YouTube and so on. You know, you get these kids now and they're just like all over it and like just don't have like any kind of worries about, you know, how they appear or what they say or whatever. But, you know, when you get a bit older, and especially the more technical you are, I think people do tend to be a bit more introverted with stuff like that. So I have tried to push the boundaries on things like that a little bit, just so I can get a feel for what's involved. And you know, exposure does sort of reduce fear to a great extent. You know, and that's pretty much true for like what you're doing, podcasting, and you know, even blogging and stuff like that. There are so many people that, you know, want to start a podcast or start a blog, or, you know, even like an open source project or something, and they're sort of scared of, you know, how they're going to be seen or judged or whatever. But then, you know, as you will know, once you get into doing it, and once you've got a few episodes done or a few projects done or whatever, it just kind of becomes normal, and you're not worried about it anymore. So I'm always trying to push with things like that, just so I'm not worried about, you know, actually taking on new projects and new ideas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what you're saying is really true. I mean, when I first started blogging about Ruby and Rails, you know, it really was kind of, oh no, you know, I'm not an expert and I don't know what I'm doing. And, you know, so I just put up, oh, well, I had a problem with this and this is how I fixed it kind of stuff. And it turned out that a lot of people really responded to that. Oh, I had the same problem. And, you know, thanks so much for your post, you know. And, you know, it's some really simple thing, but, you know, it kind of can open the door that way. And then from there, you know, I had always been interested in podcasting, and, you know, so, yeah, I mean, I did my first interview with Greg Pollock, and I was scared to death, you know, because it was Greg Pollock, and, you know, he was really nice, and, you know, after talking to him, and after, you know, kind of doing some episodes where I just, you know, kind of said what I was thinking about and not really interviewing anybody, yeah, you know, you definitely get more comfortable, even though there are things that you don't know. And I think you also get to the point where you're comfortable telling people what, you know, you don't know. I mean, you get there and, you know, somebody will ask you a question or something will come up. And, yeah, you just kind of say, well, I don't know about that, you know. But you know enough about enough to be able to talk to people. And I think that's really the point that you get to.
Yeah, I think that's kind of what I think wisdom is at the end of the day. You know, it's knowing your own ignorance, and not just your own ignorance, but the ignorance of others. You know, even people that appear sort of relatively strong online, like Greg, for example. You know, obviously he's not told me about any of his fears or worries or anything like that, but you know, like the rest of us, he's bound to have them. And you know, I'm sure he had all the nerves as well, doing like recordings early on and so on. And it's actually funny, because he was quite him and Jason Cypher, they're actually quite late onto the rail scene, sort of going from, you know, taking a long-term view. I think it was like 2007, 2008. They sort of first, they started doing some blog posts, like tutorials and stuff. And they approached me, because I was, you know, Ruby Inside was already doing quite well by that point. And they were just like, they were so enthusiastic and had such like a, well, they just had a lot of enthusiasm for what they were doing and the tutorials, and presenting themselves in a way that I'd not seen any developers in the Ruby or Rails space presenting themselves. So through video, and they were happy to do like promotional pictures and all this kind of stuff. It just made it immediately simple and kind of fun for me to promote them.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something I'm actually looking into recently, because there are a lot of developers who do great work, but they don't have a very good idea of how to present that work, or just even how to sort of do minimal kind of branding online of their like image and, you know, how to look approachable and how to look promotable and all that kind of stuff. So to sort of add to the list of projects that you mentioned at the start of the show that I'm working on, I'm actually working on a book called Self-Promotion for Geeks, which kind of goes into some of this stuff. It was initially going to be self-promotion for developers, but it turns out that a lot of the principles that are involved in, you know, promoting like software development work and libraries and stuff like that kind of cover all sorts of projects that different types of geeks are working on, even like knitting geeks. You know, they've got different projects and, mm-hmm. you know, that kind of operate in the same way. So that's one of my newer projects and something that I'm very keen to study and always trying to learn about. How can you, you know, promote stuff? How can you boost up your image? But in a very because developers look at marketing books and stuff, and they can be a bit of a turnoff because the language used, and it's a little bit brash and in your face.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a really fine line that I'm trying to walk, between actually showing you how stuff works and how people have used this stuff before, other developers have used this stuff in a non-cheesy way. So that's the current project that I'm working on, but I haven't said too much about it yet because I'm following the old don't say too much, otherwise you'll kind of jinx the project approach.
Well, yeah, and to be honest, I think that's something that I would be interested in seeing. I wonder sometimes if people don't promote things either because they don't think they need to, because they have a full-time job and they just, you know, well, I just do this as part of work and whatever, or if they just don't promote it because they don't even, you know, because I guess what I'm trying to drive at is when you're coding, you're focused on the technology, you know, you're not focused on how do I get the word out about this, you know, you're scratching your own itch, and then other people start using it and they like it, and you know, that's kind of as far as it goes, as opposed to when you're in a position like I am, or you are, you know, where, you know, you're finding your own dollars, and you know, and so you actually want to, you know, promote yourself and let people know that you're working on this, and you know that you know it's a contribution that you can make, and you know, so I think it'd be interesting. I think it would be interesting too to see how we can, you know, maybe change the mindset a little bit and help people realize how they can help themselves become more marketable, either in the job market or, you know, as freelancers or community contributors.
Yeah, totally. I mean, not just like individuals as well. I mean, it does come down to their project sometimes, because, you know, sometimes the project is perhaps more interesting than what the person is directly doing on a day-to-day, especially if they're working a full-time job and they've got this project on the side. They might not feel a need to promote themselves because they've got a great job and so on, and they just want to promote this one project. And, you know, just knowing the basics and having a very, very basic interest in, you know, how to make something presentable, I think is key, because Rails and DHH really got this right at the start of working on Rails. You know, and sort of growing along the same time as that was the Ogg Nitro framework. I think Ogg is the object grapher or something, and then Nitro is like the Rails-esque kind of framework. And this was already floating around at the time when Rails was sort of beginning to take off, but it just didn't really get anywhere, and they didn't, until later on, they didn't actually present it in a very good way. It was kind of, you know, opaque, you know, how to get involved with it, how to get the code, whereas with Rails, I think DHH attracted quite a few progressive people to help with the project, and that turned into things like screencasts, you know, and a blog and stuff like that, you know, other people weren't doing at the time. And so, you know, Rails obviously was, you know, pretty cool technology, but it wasn't, its popularity wasn't entirely on the technology. That sort of helped people once they got working with it. But the fact that it had a really cool, well-designed website, you know, which 37 Signals, you know, were involved with, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that they had the screencast, like the whole, you know, build a blog engine in 15 minutes. that was just huge, like back in late 2004, early 2005. Yeah, that was just a massive, massive deal. And the fact that you could go onto their website, and I have very vague memories of it now, but I'm pretty sure you could just go onto the Ruby on Rails site, and like on the front page, it literally had some code that basically gave a very quick, basic demonstration of how it worked, and you know the principles involved and how simple it was to make a web app with it. And this was just mind-blowing at the time. So, you know, people who are developing their own libraries for Ruby or plugins for Rails or whatever, it seems to be the ones who, you know, either has to be like a really, really mind-blowing concept that works really, really well, or you can take a slightly more mundane concept, but if you present it well, it will take off. And, you know, running Ruby inside and, you know, reading Ruby Flow and all these kind of sites over the years and promoting stuff for people, I've seen that the people who, you know, at least put a tiny, tiny bit of effort into that. You know, it don't have to be marketing gods or anything. The people who do that tend to have the most successful projects, mm-hmm. And the most successful, you know, impact with those.
That's interesting. That's really interesting. So, you know, you brought up Ruby Inside and Ruby Flow. Now, I was reading the transcript of an interview you did a couple of years ago with Jeffrey Grossenbach for the Ruby on Rails podcast. And you said that you started Ruby Inside and Rails Inside to kind of promote your book. How has it changed since you started it?
That was actually quite a short-term thing. I'm trying to remember the dates involved here. I think... I can't remember the exact date now. It's that long ago. But I was approached about the book, and we were sort of working on the basic outline of it, and I thought... you know, there were quite a few people at the time, quite progressive authors who were starting blogs to, you know, help build up an audience for their book. And I'd read stuff that said, you know, publishers, you know, while they will often help with the marketing, they, you know, sometimes they don't. You know, and you need to do a lot of the groundwork yourself. So I thought, great, okay, I'll start a blog. And there was a real lack of sort of Ruby news blogs at the time. There was, I can't remember what it was called now, but Artema, Ruby Journal or something. There was like this site that sort of posted longer articles about Ruby-related, you know, discoveries and mm-hmm. you know, concepts people had come up with. But there was no actual kind of like bitty kind of like, oh, here's this new library, here's this new tool, oh, this release just occurred, you know, Ruby 1.9's been released and all this kind of stuff. So I thought I'll do something very, very basic like that and also mix in some tutorials and sort of little tiny itty-bitty pieces of code that I've discovered and tricks I found and so on. So I got going with that. And I can't really remember how I promoted it now. I think probably I mentioned it on the Ruby Talk mailing list and a few other places that Ruby developers congregated at the time. And it grew quite slowly. For the first year, you know, it was sort of 200 readers 1 month, and then 300, and then 600, and then 1,000. And it just sort of, you know, dribbled up. But then once it sort of went over a year, and then eventually, like, the book was actually released, it basically turned entirely into a news site. You know, there was even a reduction of, like, the tutorials or anything like that. It was pretty much just the news, because that's what people seem to respond to. And from there, the subscription just kind of blew up after about year one, and sort of went from, like, 1,000 subscribers after several months up to, you know, sort of 10,000 at the end of the second year. And just kept blowing up from there. So it seemed like there was a real void for that, and that's what people wanted. You know, if they wanted to see little bits of code or cool tricks or whatever, they could just go to, you know, other people's personal blogs where that was becoming quite popular. But we were the only people doing news. Hmm. And it just seemed to take off from there.
Huh, that's really interesting. So are Ruby Inside and Rails Inside kind of the same thing, just focused on like Rails and then I guess not Rails or general Ruby topics?
Well, Rails Inside came out after about, I think, 18 months after Ruby Inside, because I realized that a lot of the stories on Ruby Inside were rather Rails-specific. They were things that if you didn't use Rails, they wouldn't be any of interest to you. There was no real crossover, and so... I've always been a bit of a, I guess, a bit of a Ruby elitist in a way, in that, you know, my sort of love is first for Ruby over Rails. You know, Rails, I can sort of take it or leave it, even though I do use it. I play with other things as well, like Sinatra, and I played with Ramazé for a while. So I thought it'd be best to split them out, and then the audience could kind of sort themselves out. But it didn't actually do too well, Rails Inside. And I know I say that even though it has 7,000 subscribers showing up on FeedBurner, but in relation to Ruby Inside, you know, it wasn't a massive runaway success at all. And I think it's almost a year ago now, I kind of sort of semi-abandoned it and said, you know, if you want to send in articles for me to, you know, post to it or whatever, then fine, but I'm not going to actively, you know, pursue putting stuff on there anymore. Mm-hmm. And if you go to Rails Inside, you'll see, I think there's been about sort of 10 posts in the last year. It's been very, very slow, and most of those have been guest posts. You know, it's Ruby Inside, as I've gone back to giving that the entire focus. And even if there is something that's a little bit Rails related, it will go on Ruby Inside now, just because that's, you know, I kind of learned from that experiment that was the way to go. Just focus on the one, you know, one topic, one site. And then I sort of branched out with other things like the Ruby Flow and Ruby Weekly. And they were more about staying with the same topic, but presenting it in different forms. And I seem to have had a lot more success with presenting things in different forms than branching out the topic area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's interesting too. I mean, I use Ruby Flow whenever I post something to the screencast or a new podcast interview or episode or things like that. And, you know, it seems like there are a lot of people that, yeah, they just browse through there, see if there's something interesting, and then pick it off and go check it out. And, you know, I probably get quite a bit of traffic off of Ruby Flow, and it's because, you know, a lot of people are there getting great content, and, you know, and I'm hoping that, you know, some of the content I put out there will help somebody out, you know. And Ruby Inside, you know, it's just such a great resource. And, you know, even if you're going back through the archives and kind of looking for something in particular, you know, a lot of times, you know, you'll find an answer there. I mean, even if it's just a link and, you know, a short description of something somewhere else, you know, it's really become, I think, one of the premium places to go and get information or just see something cool that somebody did with Ruby.
Yeah, I think there's about 1,200 posts now, so you know, it gets a lot of traffic. Even if I didn't post to it again, there's so much traffic comes through Google now because it comes up on so many different searches for different Ruby projects and so on, that it's just insane. I think one of the ones that gives quite a lot of traffic is just Nokogiri. I think it comes up result number 2 or 3 for that, just like the announcement.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, getting crazy traffic from things like that. And especially some articles I wrote in the past, the highest traffic post on Ruby Inside is a post called 19 Rails Tricks. I think most Rails experts don't know or something. It was something a little bit cheesy like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it still gets traffic, crazy amounts of traffic. You know, it's at least a few hundred page views a day still. Just people typing in Rails tricks or Rails tips into Google. So yeah, there's lots of interesting stuff in there. And unfortunately, that post is kind of out of date now. Like most of those tricks, everyone knows the tricks now. So I should probably rewrite the post. You know, and there is a lot of link rot in there because, you know, more so than perhaps other languages, people tend to move their Ruby blogs around a lot and change where they host their projects, and they move them onto GitHub and stuff like that. And so a lot of the old posts end up linking to places that just don't exist anymore. And that's a real shame. But, you know, that's pretty much true of the internet as a whole, and, you know, even sites like Ruby Flow and so on. So
mm-hmm.
I guess I focus more on the news and the continuing posting rather than going back and patching up stuff, although that would be nice.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm kind of the same way, you know, with code and other things, you know, where, yeah, you know, I'm not so big on going back and fixing the old content or the old code, you know, unless it's really broken. You know, I'm more interested in, you know, moving ahead and solving that next problem or writing that next article or doing that next interview or, you know, whatever it is. So, you know, I think a lot of technologists are kind of that way. You know, it's, well, I can do this new cool thing or I can go and look at the old stuff.
Yeah, it's like the, you know, everyone sort of claims to have attention deficit disorder a lot of the time, you know, and you see it a lot. And I sort of experience it a little bit. I don't think of it as a medical thing, but, you know, where you're sort of impatient, you want to always get on to what the next cool thing is, or like a new library comes out and you want to use that library in your app rather than what you were using just like last week or whatever. Mm-hmm. Yeah, which actually is true at the moment with a library called OmniAuth. I don't know if you've seen that. Mm-mm. It's like a new rack middleware that kind of does authentication like from every kind of third-party system you can imagine. Like you've got your OpenID and your OAuth, and it will work through Twitter, Google, everything. And I'm like, wow, I want to use this for all my authentication for everything. But, you know, I can't just go back and like backport all of my projects to using it very easily. So, yeah, there is a lot of jumping from new thing to new thing. And I guess I kind of take advantage of that with my projects. You know, in fact, pretty much all the projects, you know, Ruby Inside, Ruby Flow, Code.io, everything is about here's the new cool thing. And so I'm kind of encouraging, in a way, people to continue their habit with jumping from project and fad to fad. And I know a lot of developers aren't keen on that. They're like, oh, you know, can't keep up the new fad all the time. But I'm sort of usually the one on Twitter saying, go and check out this new fad or try out this new thing, just because it gets me more traffic or, you know, fits in with my aims, with my project.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of us would like to be able to spend more time, you know, checking out the cool new thing and, you know, figuring out how it works and implementing it and stuff. But, you know, I mean, a lot of people are working on longer term projects. You know, they just don't have the time or resources to switch every time that there's a new authentication library or whatever that comes out, you know. And so, you know, it's something that I think a lot of us would like to do more of, but at the same time, it's not something that a lot of us can do. So, you know, yeah. there's a balance there, but, you know, at least somebody gets to do it.
That's true. You know, and I am... Yeah, there's only so much mileage in keeping up blogs like Ruby Inside and so on. You know, it does pay for itself through the display advertising, and especially through the job advertising now as well has become a major part of it. Well, there we go. I think we've got cots rolling by in the background there. But yeah, it pays for itself, but it's not like a massive, you know, it's not a massive earner or anything like that. You know, no one's going to quit their job to do this stuff. Mm-hmm. It has to be something like me coming from a journalistic background into this kind of thing. But that's why now I'm taking the kind of the Amy Hoy, Giles Balkett kind of approach, very, very slowly and very softly of trying to develop products, ebooks, and so on. That, mm-hmm. you know, because I've got a great audience there with all of these different sites and mailing lists and so on. I actually want to, you know, produce something really, really good that they would want to buy. Mm-hmm. And this isn't a case of building up an audience just to sell to them. It's the fact that I have the audience, and, you know, other people aren't perhaps releasing the products and things that I want to see. So, you know, if I can come up with something to sell to them, then great. And I think that in the long term could actually turn into sort of the, trying to think of a good way to say this, but I guess the big money spinner in a way. You know, because at the moment I'm pretty much stuck with the advertising. Mm-hmm. While I do like advertising has its benefits, it's quite passive, and, you know, there's some really great people, great companies advertising with me. You know, it's a lower revenue thing. You know, CPMs aren't what they used to be, even in a niche like Ruby. So, yeah, making own products. I think that's sort of becoming a big thing at the moment. A lot of people have been inspired by people like Jeffrey Grossenbach. And I think that's going to sort of blow up over the next year. You're going to see a lot more screencasts and a lot more, you know, ebooks and stuff like that coming out in this scene. And hopefully I'm not going to be too far behind the wave on that.
Yeah, well, you know, I think it's interesting. You know, you talked about the big money thing. And you know, to be honest, if you're putting out something that is worth it to people, they'll pay for it. And, you know, you're still doing them a service because, I mean, They're paying, what, like $8 or $9 for, you know, an hour or so of your time. And, you know, to them, that's a great deal. And, you know, the fact that a few hundred or a few thousand people might do that, you know, it really doesn't make a difference because you're adding that value back to them, and so they can add that value back to you. And, you know, I think it's funny when people talk about, you know, making money, like, well, that's not really why I'm doing it. But, you know, ultimately, it does make a difference. It makes it easier to keep doing what you're doing.
Yeah, totally. Although I find it a little bit odd sometimes that people are so against the idea. There is this sort of contingent of people who are very much against people making money out of things that are related to open source. You know, I've seen complaints I think it was Greg Pollock made a, I can't remember what it was now, a screencast or something. It was part of the Envycasts stuff, which now is all available on Peepcode as well. And there were people like really, really grilling him for like selling this particular video that I think he'd done a presentation at a conference and then like re-recorded it at home and then like made it into more of a professional production. And people like really chewing him out, saying, oh, you know, this should be free and so on and so forth. And, you know, a lot of other people, we're just like sitting around looking and thinking, you know, like if you don't want it, don't pay for it. Like, but don't complain about it just because someone's adding something to the marketplace.
Yeah.
It's not like it's a right to get content. You know, and there is a lot of stuff out there for free that's really good, you know, like Ryan Bates' Railcast and stuff like that. So you can't really complain there's nothing out there for free, but then I don't understand why some people complain when anyone tries to make a buck off of something. You know, if it's done with, you know, good intentions and, you know, like if I took Ruby inside and put like, you know, like Internet Explorer toolbar links everywhere just to like try and get a few bucks from people downloading lame toolbars that's, you know, full of spam and all this kind of stuff, then I could see the complaints. But when someone actually makes a project, a video or something that is actually worth the $9 and puts it up and gets complaints, that's just, I don't know, just kind of alien concept to me.
Yeah, I agree. Now, I think we're running out of time, and there's something that I really did want to talk to you about.
Sure.
That we haven't discussed yet, and that is it looks like you've started and sold a couple of businesses. You might even have a couple more that you haven't sold that you're still running. What kind of thought processes go into building a business? You know, for example, you had what's it called? It was the Feed Digest.
Yeah, now called Feed Informer.
Right. You know, so I'm kind of curious, you know, what's the thought process and design process that goes into something like that where you're building a service or something that people are going to use and possibly pay for?
Entirely scratching my own itch. And until recently, that has been how every single project I've worked on has occurred. You know, it's either been to solve a problem I've got or to, as a way of promoting something that, you know, I want to make big. So like the Feed Digest, for example, started life as RSS Digest back in 2004. And it was just a simple Perl script that took any RSS feed, but at the time it was my Delicious bookmarks feed. And then it kind of turned that into some JavaScript that I could include with a script tag into my blog so that I could show off my latest Delicious links. You know, not many people were doing that back in 2004. You know, so I sort of mentioned it to a few people, people that were sort of interested in like the nascent feed munging sort of industry at the time. And other people were interested, so I thought, well, let's make it a little bit more sort of hardcore, I guess. And just over the course of about a year or so, I ended up getting lots of donations from people who wanted to use it. I sort of made it faster and faster, and then it eventually moved off of becoming a CGI script, which was extremely painfully slow, to actually becoming like a, you know, a full-on service, basically, which then became Feed Digest, you know, got angel funding, but then was sort of profitable from month one. And, you know, by the time I sold it a few years later, I sold it in 2007, I think we were at about 26,000 users, and I think a couple of thousand of those were paying. And, you know, it was going reasonably well, but the problem was my pricing model was absolutely hideous, very, very low, because I was just so naive to the business of it, that it was making, you know, more than enough money for me, but it didn't scale to the point where I could just hire a few people and so on. And I didn't want to go that whole big funding route, so I thought, let's sell it and move on to the next thing, because I got tired of dealing with, you know, server fires and whatnot at sort of 3 o'clock in the morning and so on. So I just chalked it up to experience and sold it. But yeah, very, very good learning experience. And it was, I guess, looking back at it, it was a lot more fun than perhaps I thought it was at the time.
That's really interesting. Now, it seems like you have a lot of experience in, you know, kind of building these kinds of tools and with, you know, some of the social media things. And I think you kind of hit a mix with coder.io. What recommendations do you have for people who are trying to kind of get into this niche where they're, you know, they're blogging or, you know, doing social media?
I guess I don't entirely understand the question. Do you mean like how to build up a presence for themselves?
Yes.
Online, a kind of a, yeah. Again, I think it's about scratching your own itch, but then not being scared to sort of show off the scratching. You know, everyone's got things that they're interested in and, you know, passions and things that they're researching and working on and so on. But a lot of people don't bother sharing that information. And, you know, a lot of people perhaps think they kind of have this imposter syndrome. And this has sort of been called a big enemy of, like, innovation. Because people think, oh, you know, everyone else is sort of, you know, I'm, you know, not particularly, you know, expert at a topic. Everyone's kind of better at me, better than me and whatever. And anything I say is not really adding to the conversation. But, you know, unless you're a complete idiot, it's not, that's not true. Everyone's got their own perspective on something. And everyone... you know, it's got something interesting to say, even if you don't think that's true. So there's a case of getting over that attitude and then just getting on Twitter or even just, you know, starting a blog, commenting on other people's blogs and, you know, posting to things like Hacker News and Reddit and places like that and just producing, like, cool blog posts that cover topics that you're interested in. And that's all pretty much I did from sort of 1999 onwards. And, you know, it's taken years for me to get a feel for, you know, if I want to write something that I know will next week get to, like, the top of Hacker News or at least have a good attempt at doing so, I now have a good idea about, you know, what titles I should use and what I should be talking about and, you know, how I should present that information. But it's stuff that you can kind of learn a few concepts and techniques for it. And that's sort of what I'm going to cover in my book. It's, you know, there's just so many different aspects to it. It's hard to sort of pick out a few different things. But I guess just sort of being authentic and being reasonably transparent and most of all being direct, because a lot of people write blog posts and they kind of go around the houses. They take lots of paragraphs to get anywhere. They don't put subheadings in and there's no images. And, you know, it's just not something that they would want to read. You know, so at the end of the day, you have to think, you have to go around sites like Hacker News and Reddit, look at some of the things that are doing really, really well, and look at the way that someone else has approached something and is doing well with. So if you go to a blog post that's, you know, like the latest top Ruby blog post, you know, someone said how to do X, Y, or Z, you know, and it's getting tons and tons of votes and lots of traffic from everywhere, look at that post and think, hang on, why is this so cool? You know, is it because of these diagrams they put in? Is it because the title's really direct and obvious what it offers? You know, what is it that makes it tick? And then sort of model your efforts upon, you know, other people's successful efforts. And, you know, if anyone wants to look at any posts that, you know, perhaps do particularly well on Ruby Insider or any of my sites, you know, by all means, you know, feel free to take some of the, you know, title patterns or anything I use or, you know, things like that. You know, obviously don't just rip the design, big screenshot or whatever, but, you know, I think modeling other people's behavior is a really good thing to do.
All right. I think that's some great advice. And, you know, I'm hoping that we can get... it seems like the blogging has kind of tapered off in the Ruby community over the last few years. And I'm hoping that we can get a few more people out there, you know, discussing this stuff and putting out what they know. Because ultimately, you know, I'd rather have, you know, several dozen or hundred good sources than, you know, not have them, not have, you know, any. And I think a lot of people are, you know, they have stuff that they can share. And so I really, really appreciate the, you know, the feedback that you have there.
Yeah, I think a lot of people perhaps have become worried that, you know, everyone needs to keep up in their game with the blogging. You know, earlier on, you know, back 4 or 5 years ago, you could post something reasonably simple like, you know, how to make like a very basic plugin in Rails or whatever. And, you know, it would do really well. Whereas now, you put something up and, you know, you're going to get people complaining, saying, oh, this is, like, totally obvious, this is totally easy, blah, blah, blah. You know, because the audience is bigger and more diverse, there's a lot more complaints and people sort of saying, oh, this sucks or whatever. You know, so there's a certain fear angle that you need to get over because not everyone is 100% friendly like perhaps they used to be in the old days. But you also need to bear in mind that a lot of the content that was simple and posted in the past, like how to make a plugin or whatever, is now out of date, especially with Rails, because things are changing all the time. So if anyone does want to sort of, you know, become a bit more popular or get some, you know, good traffic or make a name for themselves, you know, you can still focus on the simple stuff. You know, go out there, write something about how to do something in Rails 3 because it's so different and, or not entirely different, but there are some changes from Rails 2 that would make these articles actually worth reading and, you know, the sort of things that I would link to and mention on my sites.
All right. Well, I think we're out of time. You know, I really appreciate, again, the advice and, you know, hopefully some people can go out there and get going with blogging or pick it back up. But thank you so much for coming onto the podcast. And, you know, if you want to find out more about Peter Cooper, you can go to www.petercooper.co.uk. And he has all the links to, you know, FriendFeed, LinkedIn, MySpace, Twitter, you know, everything there, working with Rails. And you can see pictures of his cute little kid and you know, find out what's going on in the world of Peter Cooper.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, and if anyone does make any blog posts or whatever, then, you know, they're related to Ruby or Rails, just head over to rubyflow.com and, you know, paste it up there because I, you know, look through there and I know people like you and other people who, you know, promote stories do look at those, do look at Rubyflow and the things that end up there. So it could be a good way of getting some extra traffic.
Yep, absolutely. All right. Well, I'm going to go ahead and... Hey, everybody, and welcome back. That was a great interview, and I just want to thank Peter for coming onto the show. He was such a splendid guest and, you know, really gave me some great advice both before and after the show. And, you know, I really appreciate what he's done in the Ruby community. And I think people would be well served by kind of taking a page out of his book and contributing in ways that don't always amount to code. You know, it helps just as much to put something out there that can show somebody how to do what they need to do. And, you know, that's what we're all about here. So, you know, just thanks again to Peter for coming on and pointing that out for us. I also want to encourage you to go pick up his book. Now, you can go and purchase it. It's called Beginning Ruby. However, I believe that there are free PDFs floating around out there, pirated by the author himself, which makes me not feel bad about picking them up for free. So just do a Google search for Beginning Ruby PDF, and I'm sure you can pick it up there. Now, I want to remind you also that if you need some programming, training, coaching, or code reviews, I love helping people out, so just contact me, and I'm happy to help. You can find me at chuck@teachmetocode.com, or you can call me at 801-367-6164. Now, I also appreciate feedback on the podcast, and you can do that by going to iTunes, looking up Teach Me to Code podcast, and you'll find us in there. You can leave feedback, and I'd really appreciate that. You can also call in at 801-753-8279, or you can follow me on Twitter as CMaxW. Finally, keep your eyes open for that survey. You can win a book or a video, and, you know, it would really help me out in figuring out what are some of the larger issues that you're trying to figure out. You can follow me for details at CMaxW on Twitter. You can get the show notes at teachmetocode.com/podcast. And I nearly forgot to thank our sponsors. We have New Relic. New Relic is one of the best application management tools out there. It identifies trouble spots by capturing your response times, breaking down your requests. And what I mean by breaking down your requests is it gives you the time it took in the controller, the time it took in the model, the time it took in the database, and you know, just really helps you figure out where those trouble spots are. So go check them out. And finally, go check out Chargeify.com, and you know, let them take care of all of your financial troubles. You know, they really manage that well, and we appreciate their sponsorship. Now, finally, I just want to point out that you know, we have changed the slogan on the site. It is writing code is the easy part, and I'm hoping that we're helping you figure out how to think about this stuff. And finally, you can help me go to RubyConf by going to pledgy.com/campaigns /13439. Just donate $5 or $10, and I would really appreciate that to help me cover my airfare out to the conference. Thank you.